hearing for this evening is application number 11-296. The application of AT&T. Lost my agenda. Bear with me a second. My agenda.
You're bearing me with my voice.
Put my agenda away with the rest of my documents.
Man.
Somewhere. This site is located east of Route 1, Coastal Highway, 100 feet north of Jefferson Bridge Road, being Road 361A, being identified on the tax rolls as tax map ID 134, map 17.07, parcel 191. Requesting a special use exception for a telecommunications tower. Gentlemen, on this application, we've received quite a bit of information. First, the applicant is requesting to erect a 100-foot tall telecommunication tower on commercially zoned property located within 500 feet of residentially zoned properties. I believe you all have a copy of the application form and the exhibits that were provided by the applicant.
Yep.
I can give you an update on some additional information. We received 8 letters and emails in support of this application. We received 68 letters and emails in opposition to the application. There was some minor duplication on just a few of the letters in opposition. They were sent to duplication to different parties. So got copies of several for the same letter.
Okay.
Two different addresses to different parties. I received one letter that was kind of neutral. It really didn't take a position for or against. It just made reference to the need for good telephone service. I received one letter from the Sussex Conservation District. Short, and since it's from an agency, bear with me and I'll read it. It's only a paragraph. It's from Jessica Watson, from the Sediment and Stormwater Program Manager for Sussex Conservation District. So that I understand that the above reference project is scheduled to go in front of the Board of Adjustment next week. I wanted to make sure that you were aware of Sussex Conservation District's requirements of the proposed tower. Since there is a sediment and stormwater plan associated with the property, being the PEPUP and Arby's, and they will be reducing pervious areas as well as encroaching into the stormwater pond, we will require the submittal of sediment and stormwater calculations to verify that the pond complies with state sediment and stormwater regulations. This information has not been submitted to our office at this time. So that's just a put the applicant on notice type letter. The one letter I did reference to the kind of neutral, it's a matter of opinion if it's neutral. It's an email, it's from Angela Horning. It states, while I agree that the site of the tower in this location would be undesirable, I must say that anyone with AT&T struggles to get decent phone service while in Bethany. I wish there were another option. I continually miss calls and texts, as do my guests. I checked my emails right up till 4:30 today. And the numbers that I gave you, the 8 letters in support, 68 letters in opposition, the 1 neutral and the 1 conservation district, were the only letters and emails I received to date. Copies of all letters and emails will be made available to the board. And what I intend to do is I'll pass down the ones so you can review them as the meeting progresses, and then we'll copy them after the public hearings are over.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to note that I received 2 letters at my home, one from a Barbara McNally and one from a Fred McNally, and since they were received outside the public hearing, I'll submit those to the secretary, and they won't be considered.
Okay. I also received that, Mr. Chairman.
And all the members got the same thing?
Yep, I also did, too.
I think they're the same names in those letters that we received.
Okay.
So they will be a part of the record. And even though they're duplicated.
Okay.
That's all I have, sir.
Mr. Chairman, I've got a question to ask you first.
Yes.
This is a different case because it's going higher, or what's the difference in this case than what we had before?
Mr. Workman, I'll leave that for the applicant to address, but we do have to review this at what we would call a de novo, which means that what we heard in the prior hearings is to be disregarded. Doesn't mean that somebody can't introduce something that maybe had been introduced at one of the prior hearings, but this is a de novo hearing, which means we've got a fresh slate. So,
How's it fresh? It's in the same place, same tower, same piece of property, everything else. How's it different? It's got to be different for us to hear it, right?
No, it does not.
It doesn't?
No. The Supreme Court reversed the board's decision.
Okay.
But they do not have a remand feature as part of that. The statute doesn't afford them to just dictate how the board should act. So what that does is it allows the applicant to reapply to the board. Okay. And because it's a new application, it's as though it's a fresh slate.
Okay.
So that's what, how we've been treating it as though it's a de novo hearing. So what the applicant will present tonight is in the public record. What Mr. Lank has just told you that he has is in the public record. Whatever supporters or opposition are here, whatever they present will be part of the public record.
Okay. So. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Richard Forston. I am the attorney here on behalf of AT&T in connection with their special use exception. Before I go through my prepared remarks, let me just respond briefly to Mr. Workman's question. This application is slightly different than what was before you in the past, in that one of the complaints that nearby residents had was that the tower was only 71 feet from the property line, and if somehow the tower were to fall over, it would fall over onto their property. We have been able to reposition the tower so it is now more than 100 feet from the property line, and therefore that concern or that threat is no longer realistic. And that, incidentally, is why you heard Sussex County saying that they're going to need certain additional information from us, which we're going to supply, assuming that we get permission from you all, because what we did was we moved, you'll see on the plan when it's presented, we moved the tower back and it went into the stormwater pond a little bit, so we're going to have to do a little bit of work there. But it is different in that material respect, and I think it is important because it was one of the concerns that folks had.
Wasn't there a difference in the height?
Beg your pardon?
Wasn't there a difference in the height of the tower?
No, the tower's still 100 feet. That was always the intent. So with that, as I say, my name is Richard Forston here on behalf of AT&T, and as the board has already noted, there had been a hearing in 2009 where the tower was approved. That decision was reversed, and then the application, we came back to you in 2011, you all denied. That decision has been reversed. So we're here for a third time. Before I call our witnesses, who will all be, I think, relatively brief, I just want to do two things. I want to provide some background context to this application because I think there's been a fair amount of misleading, I'll say false, or otherwise unfair statements made in the press recently about AT&T, and I just don't think they're fair. And then I also want to briefly address the legal standards so that you have them in your mind as we're going through the presentation. I mean, there's people here tonight, and they live in the community that surrounds this Arby's BP gas station, which is where the proposed tower is to go. And look, we understand they're concerned about their community, and that's commendable, and they're out at a public hearing. And you know, I always think it's great when the public is at a public hearing. Sussex County Council says that if you meet certain standards, you can put in a cell phone tower. And those standards are in the code, and we're going to address them tonight. And so while I get that there are neighbors who don't want this tower, I mean, most people just don't want anything near them. There's a word for it, you know, not in my backyard. We're going to concentrate on the standards and ask you to do the same, which I know you will do. It may seem hard to believe, but AT&T has been at this since 2004. It was 2004 when AT&T first identified a gap in their coverage, and you heard the one woman who sent the email. They're still having problems. It's been a long process. dozens of sites in the area were evaluated. Property owners were contacted. Could we use your property? You may recall last time that folks from Bethany Beach came and suggested that, in fact, the town council from Bethany Beach came and said, you can go on our water tower, or you haven't asked to go on our water tower. We had. They had said no. After they came here, part of your decision said we could have gone to Bethany Beach. We went back to them again, and they said no. But we've looked. This is it. If we could find another site, we would, because we don't like controversy any more than you do. We don't like upsetting people. That's not our business. Our business is to provide wireless service. And AT&T does not make these decisions lightly. It costs a lot of money to put up a tower. They got to pay lawyers, which they hate to do. They've got to pay engineers. They're better. But the point is that if there wasn't a demand for a cell tower, we wouldn't be here. And we're going to show you some of those statistics about demand just on the temporary tower that is there now. On the FCC website, the Federal Communications Administration, it reports that 70% of all calls, of all 911 calls, are now made on cell phones. 70% of all 911 calls are now made on cell phones. Back in 2004, when we first started this process, if you can think back that far, it's hard to believe, there was no such thing as an iPhone. There was no such thing as a smartphone. There was no such thing as an iPad. And today, I suspect more than half of folks have smartphones. They've got iPhones, they get access to their email, they get access to the internet. They send text messages, they use Twitter, they post on Facebook. All of those things create such greater demands on the wireless networks than used to exist. And you're going to hear testimony. AT&T has experienced a 30,000% increase on their data traffic in the last 6 years. 30,000%, not 300%, not 3,000%, 30,000%, a stunning number. And in fact, they expect that data traffic demand will continue and increase some 13-fold between now and 2017. I mean, people are just hooked on their phones. You don't go anywhere without them. And it's that demand that led AT&T to start the process all those years ago. It's that demand as to why AT&T is here tonight. And I just think it's unfair to cast aspersions at AT&T and somehow say we're out to ruin the beach or something like that, which is what some people have said. We're here because people want wireless service. We're here because there's been incredible demand. If that wasn't true, we just wouldn't be here. Now, AT&T is a licensed provider from the FCC. And before the erection of the temporary tower that was there, there was a significant gap in coverage. There's still problems because that's only a temporary tower. It doesn't have all the capacity that a full tower would have. But things are a lot better, and we're going to tell you about some of the statistics that, just about the use of that temporary tower. The site otherwise complies with the requirements for your code. It's 1.35 acres in size. The property is zoned C1. There are certain things that we have to do, and we'll provide testimony about it, in order to get a special exception for a cell tower. We have to show that existing structures within 2 miles are not available for co-location, and there aren't any such structures available. Either because they're just not available, Bethany Beach said no, South Bethany has said no, or they don't solve the problem. South Bethany's water tower, for example, even if it was available, wouldn't solve the problem. The monopole that we're going to put up has to be designed to accommodate at least 2 additional providers. It is. It has to be set back from adjoining property lines at least 1/3 of the height of the tower, which in this case is only 33 feet. We're set back more than 100 feet from either of the Sea Pines community property lines. We're set back, I have it written down here somewhere, but we're set back 250 feet approximately from Route 1. And then the property to the immediate north is just some, it's treed and it's wetlands that I understand is not developable. We're set back 60-some feet from that property line as well. Your pad site and ground equipment must be surrounded by a 6-foot-tall fence. It will be.
You have to have warning lights every 50 feet of elevation, so there'll be one light at 50 feet, there'll be one light at 100 feet. They will not be blinking, which is something that people have complained about in the past. Our tower is 100 feet, which is the minimum, or proposed tower is proposed to be 100 feet. Under your code, we could actually go up to 150 feet. We don't need to go that high, so we're not going to go that high. And then in addition to the technical requirements for the monopole itself, we also have to meet the standard, and this is what your code says. It will not substantially affect adversely the uses of adjacent and neighboring property. Now, interestingly enough, that provision which I just read you talks about the uses of adjacent property and not affecting the uses of adjacent property. It doesn't say anything about value when you read it. But we have two MAI qualified appraisers who will demonstrate that the tower has not had, there's a temporary tower there now. And so we're in a very unique situation, unlike I think other special exceptions that you've had come before you in the past. We have data from before the tower going up, we have data after the tower coming up. And what you're going to see is that the property values in the Sea Pines community, which immediately surrounds two sides of the Arby's and BP gas station, their property values move in approximately the same way that property values do for all of Bethany Beach to Fenwick. We were able, and we'll hear testimony about this, we were able to have one of our appraisers go through and look at all the properties that sold between Bethany Beach and Fenwick over the last 6 or 7 years. And it was going up. Then some bad things happened in the economy. It went down, started to go up again. And now, sadly, it's actually gone, started to go down again. And that was for that area in general. Then if you look at the sales that occurred at Sea Pines, and there's been a number, they do exactly the same thing. They were going up, then they went down, then they started to go up again, and then they went down. And it's you'll see that graph. So the point, and the other thing I should say, we also looked at sales over the last 2 years, all the sales of two-bedroom condominium units that don't have a view of the water, which just describes Sea Pines, it describes other condominium units. Again, from Bethany Beach to Fenwick Island, so we're looking at sales in the same area. Of the top 10 sales, 6 were in the surrounding community, Sea Pines. So again, you'll hear further testimony about this, but I would respectfully submit that even despite what individual property owners may claim, the tower itself isn't having an effect on value. And in fact, there's a reason for that, and it's counterintuitive, but it's there. I mean, when you'll see some pictures and you'll look at the surrounding area around this property, there's an Arby's / BP gas station with a drive-through in the back. There's a hotel across the street. There's a furniture store. There's Route 1. There are high power lines that run across the front of the Sea Pines community. A cell tower is just another fact these days of kind of this urban setting. People need cell towers. They expect cell towers. They need power. They see power lines. They don't get upset. They don't say, I'm not buying here. There's a power line. They need phones. They see phone lines. They don't get upset and say, well, there's phone lines. That's it. I'm not buying here. They need cell phones. They need to use their iPad. They see a cell tower. It's not the end of the world. That's what the data will show. And we're here demonstrating that we meet the standards in the code. And that's what we're trying to stick to. So with me tonight, I have several witnesses. I have our site engineer, Mario Calabretta, and he'll testify that this tower meets all of the applicable requirements in terms of building codes, safety codes, etc. We have Brock Riffle, who's our radio frequency expert. He's going to talk about the need, the gap, and what we need to fill the gap, and he'll identify the gap. We have Tom Zolna, who's our property acquisition specialist. He's the gentleman tasked with finding a site. Probably one of the most thankless jobs that someone can have. We have two appraisers. We have Leland Trice from the Trice Group, and we have Bill McCain from W.R. McCain. They've done some very thorough analyses. And finally, we've got Dr. Ken Foster, who will simply testify regarding compliance with radio emission standards and that sort of thing, and he'll testify that we are in compliance with all federal requirements. And so with that, at this point, unless you all have any questions you want to ask of me, and I'm just here to direct traffic now with witnesses, but I'm happy to answer any questions you might have. I'd like to call our witnesses. I promise I'll be as brief as possible. I also, with your all's permission, I put together a binder of the various appraisals and other documentation. I've actually got a copy for each of you and a copy for the assistant county attorney. And then I'll have a copy for the witness so that as our witnesses testify, I'll just have them verify that, yes, tab 6 is my appraisal, or yes, tab 11 is my safety report, okay, and that sort of thing. So, this, I should have introduced Mike DeNote. This is my colleague, Michael DeNote, who's assisting me this evening. So with that, if you all are ready, I'd like to just call our first witness, Mr. Brock Rook.
That'd be fine.
Yeah.
One question.
Sure.
The realtors, are they from that area?
Beg your pardon?
The realtors from that area down the beach?
Yes.
You have testifying tonight?
Yes.
They are? Okay.
Yes. And they do a lot of work in Sussex, and they're happy to answer any questions you have about their qualifications. I think you got to go this one.
Good evening. Please state your name and address for the record.
Sure. It's Brock Riffle, 1637 Jones Ave, Phoenixville, PA.
Do you swear or affirm the testimony you're about to give is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Where do you have the witness?
The podium is probably the best place. We want to make sure the mics can pick up whatever he says for here and posterity.
Exhibit over.
No, leave it there. I'll go over there. But
can you bring it a little further this way so this end can see it, then cock it so our attorney can see it? It
might be easier to put it over there,
yeah,
closer to Mr. Lank.
There you go. Yeah, cock it so we can see it. There you go. That's.
Don't worry about
see
me.
See it down there?
I have a copy in the
phone.
You
see it, John?
Yeah.
Jamie, can you see it?
Yeah.
All right. Could you state your name for the record, please?
Sure. It's Brock, B-R-O-C-K, Riffle, R-I-F-F-E-L.
And by whom are you employed?
I'm employed by a company called RF Services Incorporated.
And what do you do for that company, and what does that company do?
I'm actually a partner, and RF Services provides radio frequency network design assistance to the wireless carriers.
And could you explain a little bit more about what radio frequency network design is?
Sure. Essentially, as we're going to be discussing a little bit later, there are several components to a network. That is the user device, the phones, the tablets, the smartphones, et cetera. And then there's the network, which entails of the antennas, the base station equipment, as well as the backhaul equipment, as well as all of the data centers that are used. All of these work together in conjunction to allow a wireless subscriber to utilize their phone for everything that we know it does today, voice and data traffic.
And do you provide these services for AT&T?
I do.
And in your experience, approximately how many cell tower locations have you worked on over the years?
I've probably evaluated and designed well over 2,000 radio frequency facilities throughout Delaware, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Maryland.
And just so the record is clear and so we can confirm some of the things that I said during my opening statements, was I correct to say that AT&T has seen a 30,000% increase in data traffic over the last 6 years?
That's correct.
And am I correct, was I correct when I said that AT&T is projecting data traffic to increase another 13-fold between 2012 and 2017?
That is correct.
Okay. Well, let me ask you the question that's really at the heart of all of this. Why does AT&T need a monopole at this site?
Without a facility at this location, AT&T would have a significant gap in their reliable coverage in this area.
And as a result of the radio frequency studies that you mentioned and that you performed, did you prepare maps that show the gap in the service area?
I did.
And did you prepare another map that shows what the addition of a cell tower at the proposed site would do?
Yes, I've done both.
Okay. Can you maybe just point out for the members on the chart here? And if you want to look in your book, these exhibits are at tab 3.
Okay, so just so we're all clear, these prediction studies were created using an industry standard tool that AT&T utilizes. It's called ATOL. It's probably one of the most popular in the industry. It takes into account where all of AT&T's existing facilities are, what antennas are being used, where they're being pointed. It also takes into account the underlying clutter of the area and the underlying terrain. And just to define those for you in case you're not aware, the clutter would reflect what is actually on the ground. Is there a house there? Are there trees? How tall are they? And the terrain, obviously, is how high the dirt is. So AT&T's tool actually takes a marker at every 25 meters, so it's very accurate. And then the tool, utilizing all of those parameters that I just said and a propagation model, can accurately predict where AT&T will have or will not have reliable service for their customers.
And so this first chart that's up on the easel shows a large white area centered around, it looks to be Bethany and South Bethany. And what does that white area indicate?
That white area indicates an area of unreliable service for AT&T's customers. It's roughly 2 miles long and extends along Route 1 from north to south, and it also extends towards Ocean View to the west.
And so this second chart is labeled AT&T service with the facility, I'm sorry. And there's now a large purple area where that white was. What does this chart represent?
Correct. So we're using the same exact tool, and now we are predicting what the facility that we're discussing this evening would provide as far as reliable service to AT&T's customers. As you can see, the proposed facility will provide reliable service to AT&T's customers throughout the area that we previously had a gap in coverage.
Okay. Now, interestingly, and as I said, unlike most applications that come before this board, because we had gotten approval in 2009, we actually put up a temporary tower. It's not quite 100 feet tall. It doesn't have quite all the capacity. But have you had an opportunity to review the usage statistics related to that temporary tower?
Yes, I have.
And are these statistics at tab 2 in the notebook, which has been provided to the commissioners?
Yes.
So you need this? I'll turn this around up here if you want to talk.
So the chart that's now on the board up on the easel and is at tab 2 is labeled total calls in 2003 exclusively from temporary facility. Can you explain to us what this graph represents?
Yes. AT&T was able to pull some network stats from that temporary facility to show the call volume that goes exclusively through that facility for all of 2013 to, I think it was pulled to the 13th of November. So the axis on the left is actually a number of calls either received or made by an AT&T customer, and the axis on the bottom is the date, so time. So in 2013 alone, this facility handled roughly 4,000 calls a day. And in the peak summer season, June, July, and August, this facility on average would handle over 10,000 calls a day. Another thing that's interesting to note on this graph is some of the even higher peaks, where, for instance, the large peak towards the middle of the graph actually represents July 4th weekend. And as you can see, the site handled or tried to handle well over 25,000 calls during that period in a day. You'll also notice that there's some other peaks. To the left, there's a peak that's basically Memorial Day weekend. All the way to the right, you can see Labor Day, because that's also another peak. But as you can tell, throughout the whole summer season, when it's most busiest down there, you have a very high call volume.
I ask you a question. Do other suppliers have the same problem you're having?
I'm not necessarily privy to what other wireless carriers have in this area, because that's mostly confidential, but I can tell you that the demand is there. I mean, AT&T's one of the largest carriers, if not the largest carrier in the area, but there's also other carriers that are very sizable. They also have customers in this area, and I would assume that they also have similar issues.
Okay. Thank you.
All right, flipping the easel now, also from tab 2 in the book is a chart entitled Temporary Facility at Proposed Location Usage Summary. Is this consistent with the graph you just showed us?
Yes, it's actually using, for the voice traffic, the same exact data set, and it's just a couple bullet points that itemize some of the things that were on the chart that maybe couldn't be seen. So number one in 2013, meaning January through November, that facility alone handled 1.4 million calls, and that's where we get to the average of roughly 4,000, which I testified to earlier. Additionally, that's of importance is that site alone, during the summer months of 2013, handled 193 emergency calls to 911, and that averages out to just over 2 emergency calls to 911 a day, exclusively handled by that facility.
And that's during the summer?
That's correct. Another thing that's important, and as was spoken to the opening statements, is how much data actually goes through these facilities nowadays as well. And so we captured some of that in our summary as well. In 2013, this facility exclusively handled over 9.6 million megabytes of data. So that's roughly 30,000 megabytes a day. During the peak summer months of 2013, roughly 6.7 million megabytes of data were handled. And just to put it in perspective, I did a calculation on the bottom there that said if you were to just use that data allotment for email and use the average size of an email, which is 75 kilobytes, each day 930,000 emails would go through just this facility alone.
Is that texting too you're talking about?
Well, it's a very good question, actually. All of data is kind of roped into one, but I was using the emails as just an example. If it was exclusively just email, that's how many it would equate to. But, of course, we know that people are using their phones for texting, email, internet, streaming, movies, you know, all of the other things that smartphones and tablets and phones do today.
And this data that you just reviewed for the board, this is based just on the temporary tower in 2013, is that correct?
That's correct.
And based on the usage of the temporary tower, can you describe for the board what the effect would be if the temporary tower were removed entirely and there was no tower there?
Yeah, a very high percentage of all of the calls and data would no longer go through, and that whole area that was in white would again become unreliable.
And so when you say a very high percentage of calls would no longer go through, could you give an estimate if right now, let's say, 93% of calls are going through, what would that drop down from if that tower were no longer there?
I would estimate that maybe 20% of all the calls would then be handled by the neighboring sites that could reach those phones.
And what about the other 70-some percent of calls?
They would be unreliable. They may either would not go through, or if they did go through, they could be of poor quality. The phone call may drop. They may have a hard time putting up another one. Or if the call does hold, they could have poor voice quality on either end.
And there's a big peak during the weekend of July 4th, as you might expect. This is a beach community. And I think the graph showed over 25,000 calls that weekend. How dramatic would the drop be for the high demand weekends?
During times of heavy usage by all of the network, that percentage would drop. I would expect maybe 5% or 10% of the calls to go through. Just to put it in perspective, since this is a temporary facility, it doesn't have all of the capacity that a full macro site would provide. And in 2013, during that July 4th and 5th weekend, roughly only 30% of the calls could even be handled just because of the sheer volume and that this temporary facility could not handle it.
So, jealous. Just to sum up then, in your professional opinion, as someone who's done this for a significant number of years, is this tower needed by AT&T?
Yes, it is.
Unless the board has any further questions, well, before I go to that, we're going to hear testimony from Mr. Zolna in a few minutes about some other locations in the area that didn't solve the coverage gap. So while you're up here, let me just ask you about those. South Bethany has a water tower. Would placing, using that water tower as a location solve this coverage gap?
No, it would not. We did investigate the possible use of that facility when we thought that it might be available to us, and unfortunately it just didn't provide the reliable service to the downtown area of Bethany.
And there are also some other cell towers to the west, and I believe south of South Bethany. Would any of those towers solve the coverage gap?
There are three towers that are owned by American Tower Corporation, and unfortunately, they're located very close to AT&T's existing site, which on the prediction plots was labeled Beaver Dam. So unfortunately, those three facilities that would be available real estate-wise for AT&T to use do not solve the coverage gap. In fact, they basically just provide redundant coverage with what the Beaver Dam site does today. So unfortunately, they would not solve the problem.
And the height of the monopole is proposed to be 100 feet. Is that the minimum height necessary?
Yes, it is.
And why wouldn't the tower work if it were shorter?
The main thing that we're up against in designing a network in this area is the clutter. You have a significant amount of houses that are very close together, and probably even more important is you have a significant amount of mature trees. Many of them are 55, 65 feet tall, and they're also evergreens or pine trees, which dramatically adversely affect how AT&T signal propagates through the area, because the needles actually act like antennas because they're very similar in size.
Okay, so then to sum up, is it fair to say that without the proposed tower, a significant volume of calls and datas will not go through or will otherwise be of poor quality and run the risk of being dropped or unintelligible?
Yes, it is.
Mr. Riffle, do you provide RF information and research for AT&T's competitors?
Do I provide
Verizon or any other companies?
No, I don't. I've worked for Verizon Wireless in the past, but currently I work for AT&T Wireless, and I do not have that data.
Do you know how the AT&T's competitors manage to provide coverage in those areas?
Well, I believe that Verizon Wireless is on several of the same facilities that AT&T is on, and I do believe they're on the South Bethany water tank as well. They would be AT&T's major competitor. They're always, one and two as far as size of subscribers, et cetera. So as far as I know, they're on relatively the same facilities as AT&T is, with the exception of also being on the South Bethany water tank.
And are you the person or is it the property person that determines there's no other towers to co-locate on?
Well, within the 2-mile radius, I'm intimately aware of what facilities are available. And also, I worked in conjunction with the real estate professional that said what ones are actually feasible, what ones we can put our antennas on.
Okay. And was it because the towers weren't available or physically, or because they weren't available for AT&T?
I think that answer is twofold. One, there's just not any available tall structures that would allow us to hang our antennas on and provide the reliable coverage. And the two is the facilities that are available are in the wrong locations. For instance, the 3 American Tower sites that I mentioned, they would be available from a real estate perspective. Unfortunately, they're, you know, within a tenth of a mile from our existing facility. So if our existing facility isn't covering the gap in coverage, neither would any of those American Tower sites as well.
Thank you.
If I can just follow up to Mr. Mill's question. Bethany Beach does have a water tower, and my understanding is that if we were permitted to go on that water tower, that would solve this gap in coverage. Is that correct?
That's correct.
But as you'll hear later on, Bethany Beach has said no on multiple occasions, so we're not allowed to go there.
But the last hearing, they said you could or possibly could.
I'll be addressing that later on in the presentation. But I'll show you the town minutes. Does anybody else have any?
Yeah, I have another question. How tall is the pole right now? The temporary pole, how tall is that?
I believe it's 80 feet.
80 feet. So it's going to be better coverage when you go to 100?
Yes.
Okay. What's the miles that you're covering with this tower? You go.
In this area, antennas being roughly at 100 feet will cover roughly a mile to a mile and a half with reliable coverage.
All the way around?
Yes.
Okay.
Generally speaking, I mean, those things such as clutter and terrain all impact it, so it's not a perfect circle. But in general, we're looking at a mile to a mile and a half.
So you're 80 feet right now, and you want to go to 100, and you're getting good coverage at the 80 feet?
I would say it's good. It's not what we need to be designing for. AT&T designs for a reliable service for their customers so that their customers can make and receive and hold calls, you know, a very high percentage, 95, 99% of the time. They're still getting complaints in downtown Bethany with the temporary facility just because it's shorter than it was designed for.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, I believe you said that there was other suppliers on the water tower. Is that correct?
On the South Bethany water tank, I believe there is. On the Bethany water tower, I do not believe there are.
And the South would not fit your purpose, is that correct?
No, we did look at that, and actually the predictions in the downtown area of Bethany were lacking, so we did not fulfill the coverage hole that we would have down in where all of the retail shops are and the very dense area, the promenade, et cetera.
You would be dropping calls?
Correct. We would still have a gap in coverage, a gap in reliable service there.
We will have, when Mr. Zolnin testifies, he will also testify that, in fact, the South Bethany Water Tower, we can't go on it right now because although they'll let us put our antennas on top of the tower, they won't give us any ground underneath to actually put the equipment that we need for the tower. So even if it would solve the problem, which it doesn't, unfortunately, we can't use it anyway. It's full, so to speak.
So if you had this tower, say you had this tower at 100 feet now, this would be sufficient through 2012 and 2017? You're not going to be back in here again?
No.
I'm asking.
No, this would be designed for a full capacity site, a full macro site that would provide for the future.
There was a tower that we approved on the north end of Route 1 in Bethany. I take it you looked at that as well?
I'm not familiar with that facility. Can you, give me?
It's right where there's a main road that comes from downtown and intersects with Route 1. And about, 6 years ago or so, we approved a tower there.
I'm not familiar with that exact area. If you could point on a map, I could probably, you know, take a guess. But I'm not familiar with that facility. It's not constructed.
Didn't it? Yeah.
You foresee more people using your co-location? You had it?
Again, I'm not privy.
Not coming in here and asking this board again for another.
I'm not privy to the other carriers, but my assumption would be yes. And I mean, number one, obviously, we're building it for co-location. But the demand is there, obviously. There's a lot of people that live there. There's a lot of people that vacation there. The road is very busy. So my assumption would be, yes, that other carriers would wish to co-locate on it.
And Mr. Ricker, just to expand on that, as we said, as I said at the outset, this, it's designed for three carriers because that's what the rules are.
Right.
And by the way, the carriers all do kind of work together here because they're all in the same boat trying to provide service. We fully expect that our competitors, if you all approve this, will be very happy to co-locate on the tower and not have to go through the negative publicity and criticisms that AT&T has. But I guarantee you that probably even before the tower is built, we will be getting requests from others to co-locate on that tower.
Will there be enough real estate there to set the equipment?
Yes, we have to design the site in order to take two additional carriers, and so that's already been factored in.
Okay.
All right, that's where I was going. Thank you.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I've got a couple.
Okay. Go ahead,
Are you familiar with AT&T's FCC license?
In what respect?
What is required? What kind of reliability and coverage is required by that license? And if I'm jumping ahead of your witnesses, Mr. Forston, just let me know.
Well, Mr. Sharp, I appreciate the question because it was an issue in the past. And I can address that because those standards actually come from Third Circuit case law. And so I have that. I was going to actually read it in kind of part of my closing statement.
Okay. And the other question I had was, are there any, I think you've discussed, you know, some of the site location or the site selection process, but are there any other less intrusive means by which you could accomplish the goal of what you're seeking here with the reliability of coverage, or is this the least intrusive means that you could do?
I would say this is the least intrusive, meaning it's the best design for the area, the least amount of antenna locations. The only thing that I would maybe put a caveat to is in other instances, I've seen where municipalities would request some sort of stealthing, either painting the antennas or using a certain type of mount just to lessen the visual impact. But other than that, I couldn't offer up any.
I don't have anything further, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, at this time, I'd like to call Mr. Tom Zolna.
Mr. Counselor, if you can keep us on the right page as we're going through here. Thank you.
I will do that. Yes, thank you.
He said you'd do that.
Good evening. Can you state your name and address for the record?
Tom Zolna, Zolna, 200 North Warner Road, King of Prussia, Pennsylvania, 19406.
Do you swear or affirm the testimony you're about to give is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
Thank you.
And Mr. Rickard, for purposes of Mr. Zolna's testimony, I have to admit that there's really nothing in this binder that relates directly to his testimony. So you're free to ignore it or just free to peruse while he testifies, whatever suits you.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Zolna, by whom are you employed and in what capacity?
I am an agent for AT&T, and I acquire their sites and do the real estate work.
And how many years have you worked in that capacity?
For AT&T, about 10 years, and about 20 years in the industry.
And so you've heard extensive testimony already about the fact that we're here for this particular location and 100-foot telecommunications monopole. Were you tasked with finding a suitable location for AT&T in order to fill the gap in coverage?
Yes, I was.
And in looking for that location, what were you provided? How did you go about trying to find a suitable location?
Well, the RF engineer provides me with a search ring, basically a location on a map, and asked me to go out and find a suitable location for AT&T antennas.
And do you start that process by looking for other structures?
Oh, yes, definitely, because we understand that this process can be a little controversial. So we look for existing towers, existing tall structures, anything that we could use, water tanks, things like that. But in this case, there just aren't any that work for us.
And approximately how many properties or property owners did you reach out to in this process?
Approximately 33.
And other than the current site, did you get any favorable responses from any other property owners?
No.
And in the past, we've heard the suggestion that Bethany Beach Water Tower might be available. Is it available?
It's not available. I contacted them a number of times and was told no a number of times.
Okay. What about the South Bethany Water Tower? Would that work?
Well, as the RF engineer testified, I turned that in as one of my candidates, and he evaluated it, and it would not work technically. However, I did contact the town of South Bethany, and they told me there was no space on the ground for our equipment.
And in the past, some have suggested that it might be possible to somehow locate on the top of power poles. Would that work for AT&T?
No, the power poles in the area are not tall enough.
Okay. And just for the record, in your career of 20 years doing this work for AT&T, have you ever placed a cell tower on top of a utility pole?
Not on a utility pole, no, sir.
And do you recall when you first started looking for a possible location?
Approximately 2004.
Okay. We have letters that went out to all those property owners, and so I didn't make copies of all the letters because I didn't think you needed to see all the letters, but I would just ask they be placed in the record.
Mr. Forson, you can just have those directed to Mr. Lank then.
You keep talking about water towers. There's also a condominium down there. It's very, very high.
Sea Colony. I contacted them. They said no.
Wow.
Correct.
Would that have?
Several times.
You're persistent, eh?
Yes, sir.
What did they give you any reasons why? I mean, I'm trying to educate myself of why people don't want them on the towers. I know why they don't want them in their backyard, but I don't know why.
I really didn't get a good reason other than they didn't.
One good reason, South, there wasn't enough room on the ground.
Yes. Well, that's another reason for Sea Colony. They told me they didn't want me to put a shelter on the ground. They told me they didn't want to disturb the look of their roof with antennas and things like that.
Okay.
As you may be aware, parking is at a real premium at Sea Colony, and so the notion of putting anything more on the ground there is heavily frowned upon. And so just to sum up, although I think it may be obvious, is it correct to say that the only location you could find in the search area which had a willing property owner is the location that's before us tonight?
Yes.
And, unless other board members have more questions, I'll call the next witness.
Any other members? Any questions? No, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
At this time, I'd like to call Dr. Ken Foster. Uh, Dr. Foster has prepared a short report. It's at tab 11 in your book.
Good evening. Can you state your name and address for the record?
Kenneth R. Foster, F-O-S-T-E-R. My home address is 219 Buck Lane, Haverford, Pennsylvania.
Do you swear or affirm the testimony you're about to give is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
Thank you.
Dr. Foster, thank you for being here this evening. By whom are you employed and in what capacity?
Well, I'm a professor of bioengineering at the University of Pennsylvania, but I do not represent the university tonight.
And what is your educational and professional background?
I have a PhD in physics. I'm also a registered professional engineer in Pennsylvania. Since 1971, I've been doing research on medical uses, possible health risks of electromagnetic fields, including radio frequency energy. I published more than 100 papers in this area. I've been very active in professional societies, including two committees that set limits for human exposure to radio frequency energy. I'm here actually to testify about the compliance of the site with FCC exposure limits. And in that context, I've been doing consulting in this field for more than 20 years.
And so is it the case then that you were retained by AT&T to review the radio frequency emissions associated with the proposed site?
Yes.
And based on your review of the plan and documentation, what did you conclude?
Well, that even under worst case assumptions, the maximum level of human exposure to radio waves from the site would be a tiny fraction of Federal Communications Commission's limits.
And did you prepare a written report?
Yes.
And is that written report contained in tab 11 of the notebook provided
yes.
to the commission or the board members?
That's correct.
Members of the board, Mr. Foster's testimony was presented because one of the elements in your code is to talk about compliance with the federal guidelines in radio frequency emissions. If you all don't have any further questions, then I don't have any.
Would this, Mr. Foster, would this affect any medical, a lot of things are now when people are walking around or have medical monitors on them or
pacemakers or anything like that?
Since there are 200,000 facilities of this sort in the United States, we would all be dead if it did. That's a kind of flip answer, but the answer is that they don't in practice.
Professor of the college would give you a flip answer.
I would never do that. Manufacturers of medical devices are extremely aware of the fact that there are many different radio transmitters in society, and they are very careful to design them to avoid harmful interference from the kind of ordinary exposures that we get, which includes use of microwave ovens, use of cordless phones, the use of cell phones, which actually create much more exposure to a device than a wireless base station.
And you pretty much stay in contact with AMA, I guess, the American Medical Association.
Yes, I'm very aware of this issue.
Okay, so that's a no answer, right?
Yes.
Dr. Foster, let me ask you to repeat what you just said about the use of a personal cell phone compared to a tower being close to a tower in vicinity.
Okay, the exposure that you receive to radio waves from radio waves is much higher when you use a phone because you have a transmitter against your body. And likewise, if you have a medical device such as a defibrillator or a pacemaker, that receives much more exposure when you use a mobile phone next to your body or a cordless phone or other wireless device than you would receive from a wireless base station located, in this case, 100 feet above the ground.
As in the application?
Correct.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you, sir.
If the audience doesn't have any questions, I'm sure I'd like to be released, if it's possible.
At this time, then, I would like to call Mr. Mario Calabretta.
Good evening. Can you state your name and address for the record?
Mario, M-A-R-I-O, Calabretta, C-A-L-A-B-R-E-T-T-A, 900 South Lewis, L-E-W-I-S, Lewis Road, Royersford, R-O-Y-E-R-S-F-O-R-D, Pennsylvania, 19468.
Do you swear or affirm the testimony you're about to give is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
Thank you.
Mr. Calabretto, by whom are you employed and in what capacity?
I'm a design consultant for Velocitel, the company that prepared the drawings.
And what is your professional and educational background?
I'm a registered engineer in the state of Pennsylvania and Maryland. I have a Master of Science degree from the University of Maryland.
And could you briefly describe the facilities that are proposed to be here? There is a drawing up on the easel as well that shows the site plan.
Yes, the parcel in question fronts Coastal Highway. As has already been mentioned, there is a commercial business toward the front, as well as a parking area in the rear of the property and a retention basin at the very rear of the property as well. What is being proposed for AT&T is a 19 by 37 foot fence compound. Within that compound will be located a 12 foot by 28 foot shelter. It's a prefabricated structure that will house the antenna equipment for AT&T. The structure that will support the actual antennas is a 100 foot monopole. This is a tubular structure made of steel, hollow, which will actually maintain the antennas at the given elevation for AT&T. In this case, the top of that monopole structure is 100 feet. The antennas themselves are mounted to the top of that structure. There will be coaxial cables that will connect those antennas to the shelter at grade that house the antenna cabinets, which actually allow the site to function. And that pretty much explains physically what will be placed on this site.
And could you describe the setbacks that will be maintained for the monopole?
Yes. To the north, we have a setback of 63 feet to the monopole. To the south, a setback of 107 feet to the monopole. To the east, a setback of 109 feet to the monopole. And to the west, which again fronts Route 1, 250 feet.
And the properties to the east and to the south, is that the Sea Pine condominium community?
That is correct.
And so at 107 and 109 feet, that is more than the height of the pole, is it not?
That is correct.
And is this monopole designed and once constructed, will it comply with all applicable federal and state and county regulations?
Yes, it will.
And will all the necessary permits, including the Sussex County Conservation Permit that was mentioned earlier, be obtained prior to construction?
Yes.
One of the requirements under the Sussex County Code is that there be a 6-foot tall fence around the equipment shelter. Will that be in place?
That will be, yes.
Okay. And although I've said it, just so the record is clear, is the monopole designed so as to accommodate the antennas and equipment of at least two other telecommunications providers?
Yes, it will be.
The Sussex County Code actually requires that the pole be lit at certain intervals. Can you tell us what those intervals are?
Yes, the pole will be lit in two locations, at the 50-foot level and at the 100-foot level.
And those are not blinking lights, are they?
That is correct. It is a steady red light.
Okay. I believe there is a generator as part of the equipment. Is that generator meant to be running all the time?
The shelter itself has an additional room within the outer walls that will house a generator itself. The generator is there for backup power in case the electrical service in this area would go down, so that would keep the cell site running. So it's enclosed within the shelter itself. The generator itself would only run in emergency circumstances or as needed in terms of exercising it on a weekly basis or every 2 weeks, generally for about half an hour. So it tests itself on a schedule, but in terms of operational, its operational nature isn't continuous unless there's an emergency.
Okay. Unless members of the board have any other questions, I do not have any further questions.
A question, please. is that not now mandated by the federal government that you have to have a generator at cell tower sites?
There have been discussions over the years about backup power, not necessarily whether or not they have to be provided by a generator. There are alternate means, such as batteries. The only issue with batteries is they tend to last a lot less, and they're not continuous source, unlike a generator, which you can just refill with normally would be either diesel or natural gas, however the power source would function. But there isn't a mandate on what needs to be used at a site, no.
Thank you.
What kind of wind does that monopole stand?
Wind?
Wind, yes.
The codes that govern this particular type of facility are national codes, and they're based on a county level indication of what the wind speed is. In this particular area, it's 120 miles an hour.
It would stand 120?
Correct.
That area down there does have, our northeasters are sometimes a lot worse than our hurricanes sometimes, so to quote from up the coast. What about lightning, anything like that that would affect that area around there if that pole was hit? Because that is an area where most of the storms in Sussex County will go south into the Bethlehem area.
Sure. The monopole itself will have a lightning rod at the top, and the entire facility will be grounded, meaning that it will have ground rods and a grounding system at grade to dissipate any of that kind of energy. As you can imagine, being a tall metal structure, that's a serious concern for these kinds of facilities.
Yes.
This is relatively short, frankly, considering that a lot of structures are much taller than this, 150 or 200, and guide towers can be up over 1,000 feet. And that's always a concern.
That's probably going to be the highest structure down there, isn't it? In that area.
I have a feeling the sea colony may be taller. But in any case, even if there wasn't a risk per se, if there was another structure that was taller and it was metal, we would still ground our tower.
So
it would be grounded.
There's fail safe.
Yeah, we have to make sure that the equipment, which is very expensive, is protected from lightning strikes or surges.
You exercise your generator. Has it got the quiet muffler and everything on it, so you won't be the neighborhood wouldn't hear it?
It is mufflered. It's also fully enclosed. So the generator itself is in a room. The prefabricated shelter that we're talking about is a precast concrete structure. It's not like a woodshed that you might put the lawnmower in. So very thick walls, and it does have a muffler on it.
I mean, you have to have air going in at night. I mean, it's got to have to vent somewhere on it.
There are vents, correct. The noise-producing item is the muffler, is the exhaust, which has a muffler on it.
You've never had any experience of being hit by lightning and having a fire, right?
No, I've never heard of that, no.
Anything?
I mean, frankly, I assume these structures just get hit all the time because they're so tall. It's just the energy is dissipated by the ground system.
And Mr. Calabretta, just to follow up on Mr. Rickard's question, how many cell tower structures or similar structures have you designed during the course of your career?
I've been working in the industry about 14 years, and I've probably done what are called new site builds, structures like this that haven't been there prior and are new, 12 or 1,300 of those, and upgraded sites where I've worked on existing sites of probably another 1,000. So I probably worked on 2,500 sites in the last 14 years.
So you've pretty much seen it all.
I think so. I've never seen a lightning strike on a tower, though. I'm not usually standing there when that happens.
I wouldn't believe so.
And of all those 1,200 or 2,500, 1,200 new, 2,500 total sites that you've worked on, have any of those sites failed?
I've never worked on a site where there's been a failure, no.
And by failure, I mean, has it a fire falling over for high wind, anything like that?
Nothing like that, no.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Sharp?
Just got a couple. This site, it's close to the water, right?
Correct.
And are you aware of any problems with flooding, anything like that?
The shelter itself is slightly raised above grade, about 2.5 feet, and that will keep it above the floodplain. We do have a note on page, I'll give you that reference, Z2, note 7, that specifically says what the 100-year flood elevation is at this location. We are above that.
Now, I understand it's currently where I guess the existing stormwater management pond is the projected site of the tower?
It's on the edge of it. In other words, there's a basin. It's currently, I was just there today, as a matter of fact, it's currently filled with water, or portions of it filled with water. There are banks, if you will, around it where we will actually be. We're not putting an island in the middle of the detention basin or anything like that.
So you're going to have to work with the Sussex County Conservation District to, as far as where to locate the new stormwater management pond?
I don't believe we'll have to relocate the pond or do any work to it, frankly, simply because we're actually up on piers. We won't be excavating any sizable amount of earth here in terms of disturbance. We're encroaching on it in some way, and we'll determine exactly what we need to do to make sure that encroachment doesn't negatively impact it. But I don't foresee that we'll actually be doing any earth moving per se. The piers that we're going to be sitting on are small 18-inch or 2-foot diameter piers that you would see at the back, maybe the deck of your house. You would drill those down. The ones at the deck of your house are probably only a foot in diameter, but similar. There'll be 8 of those that will actually be drilled into the ground.
How far down do you go?
It really depends on the soil conditions. Generally, it's going to be 3 to 4 feet. It could be more depending on whether or not that bank is fill or if there's virgin soil there. That'll be determined at the time that the construction takes place.
As part of all the permitting process?
Correct.
And all that.
There are minimums. If we go out there and find that those minimums aren't sufficient, we'll go deeper. We'll go to the point where it's safe to do so.
And you had talked about the noise from the exhaust system. How loud does that get, or how quiet is it?
Well, noise, ambient noise is sort of relative. In the middle of the night, something that wouldn't bother you during the daytime might. The exercise of the generator itself is always done during the day, usually at peak hours, maybe during rush hour 3, 4, 5 o'clock. So it sort of blends in with the other noise on. In the environment. Again, there are vehicles, there are other HVAC units on site, other equipment. It really is a relative thing. There are, I believe your ordinance does have some decibel levels at the edge of the property lines. Whatever those are, we would meet. In other words, if you wanted to stage a rock concert, you might have to get a temporary permit to exceed that decibel level, for example. Whatever that decibel level is, if it's explicitly called out, we'll make sure that it complies with that, whatever the noise regulations happen to be.
Now, what are the anticipated traffic related to the use and operation and construction of this tower?
The site itself is unmanned. There are no on-site personnel here on any regular basis. Only a technician would come out on a 8 to 10 week cycle based on what needs to happen there in terms of checking equipment. Normally, that's a person in an SUV-type vehicle carrying a briefcase with a laptop in it. The only kind of large equipment will be just during construction to place the cabinet, to place the monopole, et cetera. But beyond that, there shouldn't be any need to visit the site on a daily basis or even a monthly basis. It's very low impact in terms of traffic.
Now, the tower itself, I believe you, or maybe it was Mr. Forston, had indicated that if it were to fall, it's sufficient distance enough from the Sea Pines community that it would not land on that community. Is it designed to collapse if it were to come down? I mean, or is it, Humpty Dumpty and it falls over? I mean, are there design implications for that?
The design implication is it's designed not to fall, not to fail, of course. As engineers, that isn't something that we design for. We don't design for failure. We design so that these structures don't fail, just like the building that we're in or the bridges that I, came over on the way here, just like the Sea Colony, which is, a multi-story structure right on the beach. All of these structures, from an engineering perspective, are not designed to fail. In terms of what could happen, the setbacks being where they are alleviate any kind of issue with that, frankly. The only thing we can do as engineers is, our options as engineers are limited. We have to deal with the codes, whatever the codes tell us. The only thing we could do is ignore the codes and build something stronger, whatever that means, if we decided for some reason that we knew better than the codes do. But we really don't have that option as engineers. If the code were to say, build it to X, we would build it to X. And if they change it next year, so it would be 2X, guess what we would be designing? 2X. So again, these are not designed to fail. I can't say that I work on structures that are actually designed to fail.
Have you had any experience in dealing with structures that close to a body of water, you know, like we're dealing with here?
You mean the retention basin?
Yeah, well, just the ocean being that close.
Again, the ocean isn't the only factor that the ocean, the only way the ocean affects the site is that when you're within 100 miles of any coastline, wind speeds increase. So the codes already allow for that. Just as if we were on a mountaintop and the wind changes in certain topographical conditions. So when you have a flat area like an ocean or even a lake, I was just working on a project actually in Syracuse, New York, right near Lake Ontario. When you have those large flat areas, it changes the wind for those areas as opposed to areas that have a lot more topography, aggressive topography like mountains and trees and houses and buildings. So the only effect has to do with the wind speed, and the codes incorporate that into it.
So that's factored all into the engineering of the construction?
Yeah, we don't even have to think about it, frankly. For example, there are going to be areas of Delaware that have a 90-mile wind speed, and then this particular area of Delaware has 120-mile wind speed because of its proximity to the ocean. Even in the same county, you could have two different wind speeds in the same county for that reason.
Okay. All right, I have nothing further, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Thank you.
I have one more question. Is there any vibrations from the wind as high up as that is? You're on sandy soil there, right?
Mm-hmm.
And like you said, you're going to have to get down deeper to really have a safety factor there. I know with the turbines that is an issue, has been an issue, that the foundation starts wearing away in that sandy area. Now, do you have any that's because of vibration. I imagine, I'm not an engineer, but I would say that's what it would do. How about over the years, if this thing is still up there, that wind factor, it's been on it for a while, do you check that, or how do you do that?
Well, what happens prior to the structure being built, the foundation itself has not been designed yet. That's going to be designed based on a site-specific geotechnical investigation. So what we'll do is send out a boring rig that will drill, and it'll drill 30, 50, 80, whatever depth it needs to get to the point where we're sure that we have a foundation that can be designed for this particular facility. Mm-hmm. There are different configurations of foundations as well. The typical one is sort of a big, it's called a caisson, just a big pier, a round pier that goes straight down. If for some reason that wouldn't work in this facility, there are other kinds of foundations, spread footings that could go sideways rather than go straight down, for example. There are many ways to skin a cat. The fact that you have multiple large structures in the area, including maybe a water tank, would be the closest kind of structure to this facility in terms of having a relatively sizable foundation and a lot more weight, frankly, than something like this. It's not a concern to me that there'll be a way to design a foundation for this. I'm perfectly confident of that.
Is there any vibration at all? With that? I imagine there is.
Well, it's very different than a wind turbine, which has dynamic.
No, I mean, just from the wind, you know, you can hear sometimes if you're staying near a tower, you can.
Oh, sure. Well, the structure itself is steel, which is a relatively flexible material.
Right.
So it will move. When you're traveling down the interstate, you see at the toll booths, there's really tall light standards, the things that hold the lights above the interchanges. At least we have a lot of those in Pennsylvania. I don't know how many of those you have in Delaware, but I see them all over the place. That type of structure is exactly the kind of structure that this is.
Gotcha.
The same manufacturer that makes monopole structures, some of those manufacturers make those light standards, and they're very, very tall. I would hazard that many of them are taller than this particular structure. This structure at 100 feet is relatively short, and the same issues that have to do with wind loading are have to be dealt with in all kinds of these, this structure or other similar structures like the light standard. So they do sway, they do vibrate, that's perfectly acceptable. Buildings even do that, frankly. Very tall skyscrapers, you can get seasick on some of these upper floors of skyscrapers. It's pretty significant sometimes.
Thank you.
You said how far are you away from the residential, if it falls?
We are 109 feet away on the eastern side, 107 feet away from the southern side. Those are the sides that represent the closest residential areas.
How about the other areas it falls on? If it happened, let's say if it happened to fall, was it electric lines on top of the gas station?
We are 250 feet away from the main highway up front. The gas station itself, the physical building, looks like it would be within that 100-foot zone. And the northern property line, we are 63 feet away from that. I don't believe there's anything built on that, on the other side of that property line, just vegetation. Looking at the aerials and having been out there, I didn't see any built structures on that other side.
We'll be showing you the aerial of this location with our next witness.
Okay.
Stand recess for a few moments.
Okay.